Hi, everyone, and welcome to Academic Dean, where we connect with passionate college leaders who share their stories and viewpoints of higher education, especially lessons learned along the way. Now, here's your host, Dr. Dave Gercheck.
Hi, everyone. Today, I'd like to welcome Dr. J.D. Rotweiler to our show. Dr. Rotweiler is the president of Cochise College in Sierra Vista, Arizona. Hi, J.D. I'm excited to have you on our podcast today.
Hi, Dave, and good morning. Pleasure to be with you.
So tell me about Cochise College and why students select your institution.
Well, we are one of 10 publicly funded two-year community college districts in the state of Arizona. We're a county-based entity. We're in the southeast corner of Arizona. So we are we neighbor the Republic of Mexico and New Mexico. So tucked down in that southeast corner, but really in kind of an unknown area for people that are outside of Arizona. They always think of Tucson and Phoenix. We're actually about 70 miles southeast of Tucson, right there along the border. You know, a really unique thing that came about in the 1960s, as we saw the ramifications of the Truman Commission in 1947 that really highlighted the need for public education to be accessible for people where they're at. And so in the 1960s, there was literally two community colleges formed each week. And in 1962, the residents of Cochise County voted themselves in a community college. They believed that higher education was important. And so from 1962 to 1964, the college worked to establish itself, opened its doors in September of 1964 to 441 students. We just completed our, 56th or 57th year of providing educational services, and we served around 9,000 students. So we've seen phenomenal growth and kind of some amazing things happen in this area. I think the history is part of what's important. Anytime you talk about how colleges or universities come into existence, it's really tied to those critical areas. At the time when the college was formed, mining was probably the big thing in the county. Phelps Dodge had a large open pit copper mine in Bisbee, the Copper Queen. The smelter was in Douglas. And so those leaders in those communities recognized with the changing environment that education would be really, really important. So they established a college, like most places, politically, with political intentions. So halfway between Bisbee and halfway between Douglas. So we have a campus on about 550 acres that's out in the middle of that area. It's kind of the oasis in the desert. Fast forward to today, we are now probably a major provider to educational services at Fort Huachuca, which is a military installation, providing training in military intelligence, as well as unmanned aerial systems. It's a schoolhouse. And so today we have a large campus in Sierra Vista, by far our largest campus, as we've seen more of the population move to the other side of the mountain. But we continue to try to serve all of our residents. We take great pride that through our two full service campuses in Sierra Vista and Douglas, as well as educational centers on Fort Huachuca, in Benson, and in Wilcox, for our very large county, we have really services for our residents within a 30-minute commute for anybody who may need to do that. Clearly, we have all the digital and online opportunities as well. But we're trying to really go back to that mission that the Truman Commission set up of getting education to the people.
Well, first, I heard that you have a history of coming from the Copper Queen.
Yep. So well, the Copper Queen mine.
Okay. Because I was a dean out at Montana Tech in Butte, Montana, and that was known as the Copper King. So I understand the mining mentality of the community sometimes. So
yeah, you know, it's really interesting. So like I say, in 1964 was really in the throes of mining and copper prices, and literally by the middle of the 1970s, the Copper Queen had shut down. Right. They were just finalizing some of that. And so I think that's the other interesting part about community colleges is our response to the people. Right. And as we move from that era into a more high tech, if you will, in things like cybersecurity, unmanned aerial systems, the college has always had a long history of an aviation program. on our Douglas campus, when you're down in the middle of nowhere, if you will, on the oasis in the desert, we have our own airstrip, we have our own hangar, we have 15 aircraft, three FAA certified mechanics, and we run a full flight school off of that. And that partners in with Fort Huachuca and what they're doing in unmanned aerial systems. And so it's really about being responsive to the community. And that was really the vision of community colleges. And I'm proud to say that Cochise College has really risen to the challenge. Despite many changes, we continue to respond and really impact our citizens and our communities in a very positive way.
Oh, great. Well, then what's new at Cochise College? What's on the horizon for you?
Well, we continue to see the changes in kind of the economy and what's happening there. So we've really began to implement some new, what's referred to as stackable degrees. I mean, I'm sure as you're aware, we're seeing an interesting change in higher education that I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later. But for our students, they desire an education that leads to a job. And from our major community stakeholders, they're interested in education that leads to a job. The only ones that are historically holding out and talking about education for degrees is higher education. Now, fortunately, community colleges have really been on the forefront of this for years and talking about those short-term training opportunities. We're talking a lot about micro-certifications, really that provide students an in and out, an opportunity to get the skills that they need. But then those skills, certificates, diplomas need to be stackable so that over time they can finish their degrees as they move into management and other types of areas. So we're working really hard in some of our critical areas around cybersecurity, trying to create opportunities for students that pick up a micro certification that may be one class. I mean, we have to realize today that education is not linear. It is really lifelong learning. And so the wide range of student populations of individuals coming back to the college that already have a bachelor's degree or even a master's degree to pick up that one course or that certificate, but also those that are coming out of high school, a more traditional student, so that they can move through. So we're doing lots of things in cybersecurity, in virtual reality. We've just implemented some new programming in what we're calling mobile trades. So we've done a residential construction trades program and an HVAC program. We're going to hire and now move into this fiscal year to a mobile program. We're going to try to do it out of the back of a semi-trailer, and we're going to take the education to the people. Even though our campuses are easily accessible, sometimes for an individual to be able to come and take that carpentry class, that framing class, or a HVAC class where they're working and living, we're going to try to get that on a cycle and move it all around our county and give people opportunities to get the skill sets in jobs that are needed right now. There's a significant shortage of craftsmen and tradesmen that can really provide those opportunities. I tell people all the time, if you're going to succeed in rural areas, there are some specific jobs that need to be filled. One of those is in allied health. So the college has an amazing nursing and allied health program. In fact, over 80% of all practicing nurses in Cochise County have their initial degrees and training from Cochise College. The other area, if you're going to be in Arizona, it's going to have to be in heating and air conditioning, primarily on the air conditioning side. People are going to always need to have their air conditioners fixed. And then we're seeing a growth, although not as quickly as in some of the urban areas, but we need people to build homes, to remodel homes, to that have the skill sets in carpentry, plumbing, electrical. So we try to work in those key areas. And so we're working in mobile trades, as I said. We're rolling out some micro certifications in medical billing and coding, EKG technician. So really working with our hospitals and other providers, trying to set those career opportunities that can be done in a short-term training sense, but then move to a long degree as we begin to look at the lifelong learning aspects of higher education.
You know, JD, I really like that idea of mobile labs. I know I've watched a few other colleges kind of talk about that. I actually thought about that also a couple of years ago for automotive, trying to do those things. It's absolute that you can have all these wonderful facilities at your campus, but if they can't get there for whatever reason, you need to go to them. So,
yeah, you know, it's really interesting, even though, you know, in the West, we're used to traveling long distances. But when you start talking about a half hour, 45 minute commute to get to your education, as well as then 45 minutes to get back home, I mean, you're taking a good portion of a day. The other part I'll mention in there that we're working really hard that we think this mobile trades program is going to allow us to do is get into our high schools. We've really seen a gutting of career and technical education in our high schools, and the colleges work really hard in dual credit and other types of things. But once again, you're always talking about transportation. And so how do we get to the people? How do we get our skill sets out to them so that they can, A, become interested in something, B, get the skills to succeed, and then help them find a job, which will be so vital to our rural areas?
Well, I think that, like I said, I think this mobile lab idea is great.
Well, clearly, you know, we're willing to share and all of that stuff. I mean, we've got to really start talking about, I mean, clearly, my passion and love is in rural Arizona. Before that, I was in rural Wyoming. I've been in rural Idaho. I mean, I think the importance of rural, if we're going to keep that as a vibrant part of the American experience, there's just some key things that have to happen there. And I've worked really hard over my career to make sure that, you know, when any of these local cities puts out their chamber of commerce, if their local community college is not on the front page of that marketing thing, it dang well better be on the second page, because we're one of the things that keeps it vibrant, keeps it healthy. And so I think we've just got to find those ways within rural parts of any state to succeed. And what are the things they need? Access to healthcare, quality healthcare, and access to education and training opportunities. So I see really a local county community hospital and a community college is vital in anything that occurs.
Well, since you mentioned a little bit of your past history with some other universities, can you talk about yourself and the path that led you to becoming the 11th president at Cochise? I think you started there, was it around July 2009?
That's correct. I've now just completed my 12th year, which makes me the senior community college president in Arizona by really a significant amount. And that may be an important part for us to talk about for future aspiring leaders and what they might do. But I'll just say, to kind of address your question, I shouldn't say I was a typical undergraduate. I was a first generation college student. And my parents had always committed to their children going into college. They didn't understand anything how that worked or how it went down. Very fortunate to have friends who came from families that had educational backgrounds. And so I just kind of tucked along with them and went along and took ACTs because they took ACTs. I found myself at a two-year junior college initially, and then transferred to the University of Wyoming and completed my bachelor's degree. As I completed my bachelor's degree, I was looking to go to law school. I always thought that's what I wanted to do. By then I was married. My wife had another year to do her student teaching. And so we just were going to stick around there. And I had a professor mentor come into me and say, JD, have you ever thought about graduate school? And I hadn't really thought about it. He says, well, why don't you think about applying for this? I might have some funding for you. I was off sequence graduating in December. And so I got offered a graduate assistantship to begin in January in the Sociology and International Studies program. Had a unique opportunity to act as a teacher's assistant. And mind you, I was doing all this just waiting for my wife to finish so I could go to law school. They then asked me to teach a class. And in the course of teaching that class, I realized I was hooked, that this is what I needed to do. And as I completed my master's degree, I took a opportunity to do a three-year replacement for a faculty member at Ricks College, which is now BYU Idaho. And so I went in as a replacement faculty for 3 years there in Rexburg, Idaho. From there, I took a job as a department chair and an assistant professor of sociology at Salt Lake Community College, which allowed me to complete my PhD in educational leadership and policy. From there, I moved to Western Iowa Tech in Sioux City, Iowa. One of the things some of your listeners probably need to understand is while you may be somebody that's pretty well situated in the West, the number of colleges and universities in the West is nothing like the Midwest. And so I recognized that I needed to take an opportunity in advancement. So I took a dean's position at Western Iowa Tech Community College, which was very much a technical career-based college, having its origins as a career and technical vocational school that had transitioned to a community college, which really helped me develop a new understanding of kind of coming out of a junior college that was more of a college transfer, you know, a liberal arts, if you will, to a very career-based, kind of opened up a new perspective for me. I then returned back to my hometown in Riverton, Wyoming, where I served as the executive vice president and provost for 7 years. Really loved our experience there. Our children kind of grew and developed there. There was actually a succession plan for me to become the president. And for some reason, a unique opportunity opened up in Cochise County and with this college. And so I was pleased to become the president at Cochise College, never thinking I would be here 12 years. By then, I'd been on kind of a career path. And so all of a sudden now to think about 12 years and no thoughts of leaving is really, really important.
Yeah, I can imagine, you know, a lot of the other guests I've had that are either community college presidents or just college presidents seem to not have 12 years under their belt. They've been at one place for 5 years and they've moved on. And I think some of that has to do, and I'll talk to you a little bit later about this with you as far as lessons learned, but I think some of that has to do with just sometimes people just want new. They just think somebody comes in with newer ideas, but what do you think, because you've been there, I don't want to say for so long, but 12 years is a pretty lengthy tenure. What do you think you bring to the table because of all that experience? How does that help the community? How does that help the college?
Sure. One of the things I've learned, and I'll tell you, I thought I was probably a five-year kind of president. That's kind of the average that's in there. But what I've discovered is social capital is incredibly important and valuable. And social capital takes time to build. When I talk about social capital, it's those connections with the various political leaders, the various stakeholders from business and industry. You just build these relationships, and then at times they'll actually provide you the benefit of the doubt. You're not a afterthought. People come to you as a change agent, able to move and do things, especially when you're talking about rural community colleges. I mean, there's outside of political leadership, there's probably a handful of leaders that are called in on everything. And clearly the community college president, the hospital CEO, in our case, with the military installation, the commanding general of the installation, as well as his deputies. I mean, these are the individuals that you come to partner with to get things done. And so building that social capital takes time. As you move to other places, you can renew that social capital. But I can tell you, based upon that social capital that I have here and in Arizona, I mean, those are hard resources to build. And it's easier to get things done when those partnerships are already built and established. And so, I was talking to some of my colleagues at a conference this weekend. I get asked to testify before the Arizona legislature all the time. And I probably have closer working relationships with legislators from my colleagues' district than they do just based upon time. And because of those connections, we've been able to, you know, create new funding opportunities for rural community colleges in Arizona. So that social capital is really, really important. I understand the excitement of going to new places. And clearly, there's lots of reasons. Sometimes the match isn't good. Sometimes there's board issues. But I will also say one of the disappointing things I see with some of my colleagues and is that we're moving around way too fast. It takes time to implement things. And new leaders always like to come in and rock the boat, shake things up a little bit. I'm certainly one of those. I'm very much a change agent. But I also believe we have a responsibility to stay there and put the pieces back together. It's one thing to shake it up. It's another to put it back together and see how all those changes have led to really effective outcomes.
Excellent point. Well, how has your presidential leadership style evolved over all these years then?
Well, I'm not sure my philosophy has really evolved. I'm still probably the same old, as many of my colleagues will say, bull in the china closet. I tend to be very passionate and very excitable and love the banter and the discussion that occurs in higher education. I will say I've probably become a little more patient. I realize that change takes time and that some individuals are much more comfortable with change than others. And the quality of good leadership really requires that we keep everybody on board, that we bring those that at times are resistant, we make sure they come along as well. And I think I've learned that over time, that maybe a little extra work on the backside, maybe a little bit slower in change. And when I say slower, while I may be more patient, I'm not overly patient. And so to bring people along is important. You know, there's some scholars out there that believe change is really about loss. And so when somebody feels change coming, there's some loss of their comfort, loss of their position, loss of their, you know. And so how do you work through that loss and bring people together, knowing that their role in the institution is incredibly important? And while their role may change, they're still important to the institution.
What's been some of the biggest lessons you have learned as an academic leader? And what advice can you give new college presidents?
Sure. I think kind of going back to where we're at, we're in the people business. So if you don't like people, and with people comes problems, then you're going to struggle a little bit as an administrator or as a college president. I'm a sociologist by trade, so I've always found that I love the people, and I love the diversity of the people. I love the suit and tie business faculty member, you know, very conservative. I like being around them just as much as I like being around the fine arts faculty, who maybe the clothing attire is going to be different, the worldview is going to be different, the political outlook is going to be different. You know, there's kind of on the extremes. I find myself as comfortable in both of those environments, and find myself intrigued by how they see the world and how they do things. That's just two extremes. At a community college my size, you know, bringing 350 full-time benefited employees, we're going to be really, really diverse. If you like that diversity, higher education is really a good place for you. And so I've recognized that while everybody may have a different perspective and everybody may have a different worldview, 99.5% of the people that find themselves in community colleges, their heart's in the right place. They truly want to impact their communities. They want to impact the lives of students. And so how they get there may be different, but I believe their heart's in the right spot. And so how do we then bring everybody together in a collective to move the college forward?
Well, what's been some of the proudest moments of your presidency there?
Well, I'll share with you one that kind of talks a little bit about social capital and how things kind of get done. So about 6 years ago, maybe 7 years ago now, we were in the throes of trying to build a new nursing and allied health building. We had outgrown our spaces. We'd moved them three times. And so we set out to do a little bit of work to build this new facility. We had sketches and we had a place for it all kind of developed on campus. I then took those sketches and went around to some of our key community leaders and said, here's what we're trying to do. Do you have some thoughts? Are there some funding opportunities that perhaps you could bring in? And I'll mention that building was going to be 38,000 square feet at the cost of about $14 million. In the course of sharing that, I came to some leaders out of the hospital area. And they were working through, we were a county hospital, looking at privatizing and doing some things because the needs were becoming greater than our local community hospital could provide. And so they'd made arrangements to privatize. And in the course of that, part of their agreement was they were going to build a brand new hospital. And so they were working through that. And as I presented that to them, they came back and said, you know, JD, we have a proposition for you that might be mutually beneficial. We have 100,000 square foot old hospital that's in the downtown area that we would donate to the college, values around $8 million. And so as we contemplated that and recognized that while it wouldn't be on our main campus, it would be about a mile and a half, 2 miles away, we took that same $14 million, now made it $15 million. We remodeled completely a 100,000 square foot hospital and moved all of our nursing and allied health programs in there. So while we needed 38,000, we ended up with 100,000. We now have culinary arts in there. We have cybersecurity in there. We have EMT paramedicine. We allowed all of our community resources, so our Small Business Development Center, our Center for Lifelong Learning. We partnered with Arizona at Work, which is the job service coming off of the federal dollars from the Workforce Investment Act. We brought in partners from Disabled American Veterans, many other groups. And so we created kind of a community center, as well as our allied health and cybersecurity area for the same dollars. And so we've taken what was at one time going to be viewed as an eyesore, a vacant building in the middle of town, and is now touted as one of the really prides of our community. We've done that in a number of areas, and that's kind of why I keep coming back to, it's that social capital. It's connecting with other leaders. You know, today, unless you're a really large organization, you can't do things on your own. You've got to have partners. And those partnerships are built by people working together, trusting one another, spending time with one another, and just really looking out not only for their organization's good, but the greater good.
Good point. Well, what are your views on the free community college concept?
Well, you know, that's a real interesting one. And I'll just say the devil will be in the details when it comes to free community colleges. I am all about access, affordability, and opportunity. And how we get to that becomes really, really key. I think we want to be careful when we label anything free. Free does not always mean good. It just means free. And the reality of it is, it's never free. It might be free in this case to the student, but it's not free to the taxpayer. And so it's not free to the college. And how do we balance affordability and free? I would like it to be free or as close to free as possible, but also recognizing students need to have skin in the game. They need to recognize that what they're doing is important and an investment. And so I think we need to work to see where that exactly goes. I am supportive of the free community college movement, but I think we need to understand that it's not free. And if we make it, if we're just moving dollars out of, so for example, at Cochise College, our tuition rate is $91 a credit, which is probably nearly free for many places. How do we take, if all of a sudden we're going to remove that $91 and the state or the federal government or something's going to make that up, the part we have to realize is that's less than 25% of the cost of that student going to school. So while it's easy to make up that piece, I have to make sure I still have the other 75% that provides equipment, classrooms, technology, faculty, staff, support services. And so I'm all about affordability, all about opportunity, all about access. We just need to make sure we set up a system that provides that, but still meets all of those other needs on the back end.
Yeah. And the other thing about that is when I've talked to some other presidents about this is, you know, when you look at the funding models, does that cover micro-credentials, certificates? Is it strictly only a two-year degree? It really, because that's what it appears, that's what students are coming to you for right now is some of those short-term credentials, correct?
Yeah. And that's really where the change is going to be, because I'm sure as you're aware, Dave, Pell Grant right now does not cover micro-certifications. I mean, it's really set at those certificates that are at least 16 credits in length. And we're seeing some changes. We're seeing some adjustments. But that's going to really be the key part is how do we ensure that we can continue to have quality programs, meeting the needs of not only students, but also the needs of their employers, their community leaders, and yet do that in an affordable and accessible way, probably trying to get as close to free as we can possibly be, but recognizing it's never free. There's always a cost. And how do we make those adjustments? I'm all about common good. I mean, that's really what community colleges were set up for. The citizens of Cochise County in 1962 voted to tax themselves for the good of the next generation. Now, when we think about that, you know, clearly, I'm not sure we would have many of our communities and counties that had that kind of forethought, that they would be willing to tax themselves in 1962, believing that we might educate 500 students and now see us at 9,000 students. That's a much more global picture, and recognizing that they were willing to tax themselves for the good of not only themselves, but future generations. That's a really important part. And I think the free community college movement has some of that in it, but it's going to take people to recognize that they're investing in the future.
That's a good point. It's safe to say that before we start looking for answers, you need to ask the right questions. So what questions do you think need to be asked regarding the future of two-year ed?
Well, the interesting part we're going to see there is, where is higher education as a whole moving? We are going to see significant transition. Now, we were already seeing changes occur in higher education. The whole COVID, the last 18 months, has just sped that up. And we've learned an enormous amount coming out of that. You know, what is it, crisis, or let's see, what's the wording there? You know, crisis leads to innovation. And so the crisis of the pandemic allowed us to rethink things and how we employ people, how we deliver education. And so because of that, we got some great innovation. How do we now tie that innovation back into a post-COVID timeframe and move us forward, recognizing now that education is not going to be linear. It's going to be some face-to-face. It's still going to be remote. It's still going to be digital. I've seen faculty at my institution who could have never thought of teaching a class online or remote that are now saying, you know, there's some good stuff that came out of this. And we're seeing things become much more hybridized to where there's going to be pieces of each of that. As long as we keep in mind we're educating the student and we keep the student as the center of our decision-making, I think we'll be fine. But there's going to be some fundamental shifts. I will say I'm glad I'm on the downhill slope of my career, not in the beginning of it, because there's going to be some fundamental discussions that frankly might lead to, you know, what is the future of higher education? I'm glad to be in a community college movement that has been responsive and able to change and tie themselves locally. It would be a tough discussion at some of our sister schools that are in the private liberal arts, small schools, heavily based upon tuition. They're going to have some real critical discussions over the next 10 years that I think will tie into really their survival, as well as the survival of higher education as a whole.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Well, then let's talk about higher ed. How do you see higher ed in general evolving over maybe the next 5 to 10 years? And I know I'm asking for kind of a crystal ball analogy, but.
Well, I mean, clearly technology is going to continue to be a driver. And how do we best implement technology that has impact in student outcomes? I think the virtual reality, the augmented reality, much of that's going to drive some of our discussions. You know, we've got to find ways that technology can help close the outcomes gap, the achievement gaps, both in degree completion, but also in just learning outcomes. And I think with good use of technology, I think we can probably really close some of those gaps. I think the other part that we're going to see is partnerships are going to become more important. There is no way to purchase all the technology that will be needed by any one community college, by any one university. And so how can we form coalitions, and how can we form collaboratives that allow us to leverage off of one another? You know, should there are 10 community college districts in Arizona, with Maricopa having 10 independently accredited colleges around the Phoenix area, Pima in Tucson having 3 or 4. So overall, there's probably 25 colleges? Are there some ways collectively we can work together so that maybe not all of us need to have our own marketing plan and content management and online providers? Are there ways that we can collaborate together to provide the services in really a very, you know, transparent way, but the student doesn't see any difference?
Right.
I mean, by and large, we're all offering the same courses, the same curriculum. Are there ways we can partner together to get economies of scale that will move us forward? I think those that are willing to partner, those that are willing to work together will be successful. Those that try to plow through on their own may find it an uphill battle.
Yeah, I would say in my career, I've seen colleges and universities kind of silo up, you know, and of course that has to do sometimes with FTE. You know, I mean, we get our money because of FTE, but I think collaboration, when you say that, that's strictly a meeting the student's needs. They don't care. They just want to get on a class and take it. They don't know the background movement of how you share that money back and forth or how you do things together. So,
yeah, you know, it's real interesting what we've seen over the last, 5 years and probably in the last 18 months. So Arizona State University has really become a very powerful player worldwide with their online offerings and the things that are happening there. Then the University of Arizona, kind of to compete with that, bought Ashford University to create the University of Arizona Global. You know, we've got Purdue University collaborating with Capella. We've got what's happening out of Maryland. And you're seeing lots of these consortiums come together. They've pretty well filled the online market. So then what's a niche for Cochise College? We know we have to have some online offerings, but our online offerings are typically tied to other programs that might require a face-to-face element, whether it be a police academy, an EMT paramedicine, an auto mechanics, an HVAC, a nursing. And so we need to find those partnerships that we can develop that allow us to continue to meet our mission. And for me, our mission is all about our community. I mean, community is our middle name for a reason. Because if our community, in our case, our county is not successful economically, socially, then we're failing as a community college. And so our communities are important. And of course, our communities are made up of citizens and their citizens are made up of students. And collectively, we need to meet students, citizens, and community needs.
I'm going to switch topics here. As we were talking, I was wondering, since it seems like you have so many things happening on your campus and as you continue to grow, what if you had some extra budget money today that had no strings attached? What would you do with that?
Well, it's interesting you'd say that, because we actually have that because of the hard work of some of my colleagues. We had some additional workforce dollars pumped into the 8 rural community college districts. And I can tell you exactly what we're going to do with ours. We're talking about creating what we'll label as the First Responder Academy. It will be a combination of our police academy, our fire science program, our EMT and paramedicine program. Now, our police academy has historically always provided lots of credits in a very condensed time. So a student can earn 30 credits in about 20 weeks. It's a residential experience. They go to class from 7 in the morning till 6 o'clock at night. We're saying, let's try to do that same thing in fire science. Why are we running a fire science program that takes 2 years? A paramedicine program that takes 2 years? What if we condense that down and sold it as a quick, condensed program? Well, in order to do that, you got to have facilities. And so we're going to look at building a first responders academy that has appropriate classroom space, has a driving range for driving vehicles, potentially an indoor shooting range, burn towers. Because it's out on our camp, it would be on our campus in Douglas on 550 acres. We can do lots of burn things. I can take an old aircraft fuselage and replicate a plane crash. I could take a train car and tip it over for a hazmat situation. You know, so much in rural counties, the first responders are the same people. So sometimes our volunteer firefighter is the same person who's the EMT, is the same person who's the police officer. How do we then provide those training and those skill sets, recognizing rural Arizona, to meet those needs? But I think we can sell this nationwide. and bring in students who are interested in fire science, and instead of it being in a two-year curriculum, have it be in a 20 weeks. I don't know exactly what that length would be. And so they get more of an academy experience. I think that's what we're going to see more and more in some of our critical areas is, can you condense it, give it in a shorter time frame, and give the students what they need to be employable, then build all of the other infrastructure, all the other degree stuff around them to help them finish over the course of a lifetime, not necessarily in the course of a degree.
That's an excellent point. You know, a kid comes out of high school, they want to be a firefighter. You got to spend 2 years to be, it just delays their career where, you know, if you could get them on a more of a fast track path, they could start that fire department, and the fire department with connections with you could do some things together and help them grow because they're going to be there for 20 years anyway.
Correct. And the other part in there is we need to set an environment, and we think that's what this will do, will allow for continuing education. So many of our firefighters, our nurses, you know, as part of their ongoing licensure, they need to have continuing education. And to make that connection is really key. You know, one of the things that I've worked really hard here is, you know, we worked on degree maps and we lay out this 2-year thing. And what we'd find is we'd take some of the courses that were in their major, the courses they really wanted to take, and we'd move those to the second year. Well, why aren't we finding ways to implement some of those specific courses that are tied directly to their interests and putting that in the first year instead of waiting to the very end? Why should a student have to wait till their freshman year of their fall semester of their sophomore year to hold a fire hose? Why aren't they doing that their very first? And part of that is, well, because they've got to take English 101 and English 102 and their math. Well, we can distribute that stuff across there as well. Let's try to create an environment where students get to take not only what they need, but what they want.
Right.
And I think the merging of that will really help in this micro certification, lifelong learning, the building of all of those key things.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think I don't know what the data would be, but I bet you anything, you've lost students over the years who just said, I came to be a firefighter, or in other words, whatever career path they wanted, I didn't want to take all these other classes first. They'd be willing to take them if they had a little bit of their pathway there.
You're exactly right, Dave. And then you combine that with, for many of our students coming out of high school, may require some level of developmental remediation. And so if all of a sudden they now, to get into, say, their college level math course, they got to take two additional math courses, and you're building up, and you know if they're in those developmental, it probably wasn't an area that they were really excited about. And now all of a sudden you've got all that building in before they even get to that course. Some other areas where we've tried to really work hard here is to really make it co-curricular. So why are we teaching math as an independent class? We're doing some things in HVAC and automotive where their math curriculum is integrated into their specific discipline. So, you know, some students will tell you, I can't do fractions. But if you ask them, so in our residential construction trades, I can't do fractions, but if we ask them to mark off on a measuring stick or on a tape measure, you know, what a quarter of an inch is, they could tell you that. They don't know that they're doing fractions. They just know they're cutting wood. And I think the more of that we can do, we learned a lot of that in our avionics program, really a traditional electronics program. So much of that math, when turned into their career interest, becomes much more meaningful. It becomes contextualized. And as it becomes contextualized, the ability to grab those concepts really becomes important. I had a faculty member tell me one time, so really what you're doing, JD, is we're tricking them into math. I said, you can call it tricking. You can call it contextualizing. Either way, they're picking up the skills they need. And at the end of it, tell them that they've now done fractions.
Good point. Good point. So here's my last question. Do you have some favorite books on leadership that you would recommend to other academic leaders?
Sure. I think as I talked a little bit about being in a people business, I've really drawn a lot from the book Speed of Trust. I think that's an important one. You know, how we build trust and how we do it. And that's a Covey book. Maybe it's even Stephen Covey, but it's Stephen Covey's son. So I found that really an important way of how we build trust, not only in what we say, but what we do. And, you know, I'm often reminded that sometimes not getting back to someone with an email or something really erodes your trust. And so how we work so hard to build trust, how do we ensure that we don't let that erode? And so I think because we work with people, trusting and really in coming through is important. The other part I'd say, not necessarily in a book, although there are books out there, I always really like Clayton Christensen and his ideas of disruptive innovation. I mean, he'd done the Innovative University, innovative things in healthcare, and just how do we go about disrupting things and then allowing innovation. I will say, I think, as we talked about a little bit earlier, higher education is about to go through a fairly significant disruption. And the question is, are we going to be innovative enough to come out on the other side, meeting the needs of what our citizens and what our students need?
Well, those are some great points as we end our conversation. So thanks for bringing those up.
You're very welcome.
Well, JD, thanks so much for being on our show. I really enjoyed our conversation.
You're very welcome, Dave. It was my pleasure to do that. And if I can answer any questions or if any of your listeners have questions, please feel free to reach out. I'd be happy to engage. And like I said, higher education is a people business. So us collaborating together and sharing ideas is how we'll get things done.
Super. Well, that wraps up today's show. Thanks everyone for listening.
Thanks for listening to today's episode, and make sure to visit our website at academicdean.com for additional information. Also, if you enjoy our podcast, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Until next time.